My name's John. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome, everybody. I want to thank the Yet Group for this tradition of the eating, speaking, meeting. This is a powerful group, and I don't get here enough, but I'm glad I'm a part of it enough to know a lot of people here. And it's the age-old tradition of introducing a speaker at an AA meeting. It's a pretty cool thing to do. Also want to welcome the visitors. Thank you for being here. But you know, that big book's got all those stories in the back, and we carry the steps and our experiences through our stories. And those the stories in the back tell us, those people tell us how they found God. And our speaker tonight's going to do a lot of that. We don't bar anyone from Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why people like Bill are allowed in the door.
What about Buster?
Yeah. And our speaker is a very honest, upfront person, so you're going to know when he's lying, just like that. And I think, you know, he has a really wonderful way of talking about this disease and an even better way of talking about the solution. Please welcome Bill C.
Hi, everybody. My name's Bill Chisholm. I'm an alcoholic. Get some things out of the way. Number one, my sobriety date is November the 7th of 1988. If I don't drink and don't die between now and November, I'll be celebrating 30 years. Yeah. I've got a home group. It's the Let It Happen group. It meets down in West Nashville. Buster, don't come. It's one of the two best Alcoholics Anonymous meetings there is. And John McAndrews is my sponsor, and he's one of the two best sponsors in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I got one of the two best home groups and one of the two best sponsors. And I hope you all got the other one. It's only two. John, you mean the world to me, really. John is my third sponsor. When I moved here 5 years ago, my first sponsor had passed away after 24 years of being my sponsor. And I was living in North Carolina at the time, and I got a new sponsor. And then Bob died a little bit later, several months later. And I moved here and asked John, and John was like, damn, I don't know if I'm going to stay sober that bad. He said, I heard you done killed two of them. I said, I ain't killed nobody. He said, well, the rumor has it that you worried them to death, so I don't know. So, but he's still here. Man, I'm nervous as hell now. It wasn't bad, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago when you asked me. It wasn't a problem. But now it's a problem now. Whew, Lord have mercy. You know, my story is real similar to a fairy tale story. I mean, it really is real similar. It ends up the same way. You know, fairy tale story, living life happily ever after. And it's kind of what I've done since I've been sober. I've had a good life this last almost 30 years. The only difference between my story and the fairy tale story is the fairy tale story always starts out once upon a time. That's just the way they start out. Mine starts out, man, you ain't going to believe this shit. That's a fact. You ain't going to believe this shit. True Lord have mercy. My wife didn't come tonight because she's embarrassed to be seen with me in public, and I'm real okay with that. But that's okay. You know, I don't talk a whole lot about my family because I look around. My family's not here, so I really don't feel like I got right to talk about them. But they're not here to defend themselves. But that's what's wrong with me is my family, you know. So it gives you an idea why I don't talk about them. But, you know, my mother had 9 children with more than one father, which tells me she didn't do relationships real well is what that tells me. I've been married twice, and all my siblings have been married at least twice. That one brother married 5 different women. He found 5 sick women. I'm like, damn, my daughter, she's been married and divorced. She's on her second husband. We don't know how to do relationships. Just don't. But I had a good childhood, you know, growing up. I wasn't quite the middle child. I was next to the middle child. I had brother and sister that died before I was born. Then I had 2 sisters and a brother older than me, and then 3 younger brothers. And Man, it was a house full. You know, it was a house full. And my mom and dad did the very best they could do with what they had to work with. And trust me, they didn't have a whole lot to work with when they had us. But we had fun. We had fun. That's what it was all about. You know, my first time I ever drank, I know this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and I respect Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want to offend anybody, but I'm going to talk about alcohol tonight. I ain't going to talk a whole lot about dope. You know, I'm just not going to do that because it's Alcoholics Anonymous. But I did a lot of dope in my days. You know, I'm one of those people, should I qualify for whatever, Narcotics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Fat People Anonymous now. I'm not qualified for any of them. But I find everything I need right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't choose not to go anywhere else. Everything I need, I find right here. And I'm real grateful for that. But the first time I got drunk or did any kind of thing, me and another little boy, we was about 8 years old. And we stole some beer out of his boy's dad's car. And we drank them, went in his garage and drank them. And then we decided to catch the garage on fire. Because I really, to this day, don't consider myself to be arsonist. We just thought it'd be cool as hell. So that's what we did. I mean, it made sense to us. And got in all kinds of trouble for that stuff. But I still don't think I'm an arsonist. But anyway, I got in a lot of trouble as a juvenile. Man, I was always getting in some kind of trouble. I was in and out juvenile court from 8 years old up to 15 years old. I don't know how many times, 10, 11, 14, a bunch. I got to know the probation officer on a first name basis. And I was 15 years old. I remember when I was 15 years old, sitting home on a Friday afternoon, the police show up. I'm really hoping they're after one of my brothers, but they're not. They're after me. And they take me to jail. And a probation officer come down to jail at night and told me, said, I'm tired of this. I'm sending you away. I'm like, oh, whatever. You'll let me out Monday. And I heard this, I'm going to send you away over and over and over again. I come to the conclusion, he just wasn't nothing but a liar. He was just making it. He wasn't going to send me nowhere. And then about 10 days later, I'm still sitting in jail, and they come and get me and handcuff me and put me back in the sheriff's car, and they transport me to reform school. I'm telling myself all the way there, he really ain't going to do this. He's going to let me go. We get there, and they escort me in, and I'm still thinking, he really ain't going to do this. A year later, when I got out, I'm like, that somebody really did do that this time. He was serious. I got out. I went out of boys' school 2 weeks, and I got in trouble, got arrested on a drug-related charge. But it was in a different county. So me being a smart person that I am, went to juvenile court, and judge asked me, you ever been in trouble before? No, sir. Are you sure about that? Yes, sir, I've never been in trouble. He said, well, you know what marijuana looked like if I showed it to you? I said, no, sir. He said, well, you had some in your pocket when he was arrested. I didn't know what it was. That's why I picked it up. You sure you ain't never been in trouble before? No, sir, I ain't never been in trouble. He said, well, according to this report here, you just got out of reform school less than a month ago. What you got to say about that? I'm thinking, man, you let me stay here a while. All this time knowing damn good well the truth. That's what I say about that. He said, well, you know, I could send you back to reform school until you turn 18. And I didn't want to do that. That was not a good place to be. So anyway, I spent that summer, me and some other kids that I got arrested with, down on the river road, chopping down weeds. We did it all summer long. Met this probation officer down there every morning about 8 o'clock, and we were chopping weeds down. That was our punishment. And I made it through all that. Thank God. Went to jail a couple more times before I turned 17. And then at the age of 17, I went into the Marine Corps. Biggest mistake the government ever made was allow me to come into the Marine Corps. They really shouldn't have done that. They really should have. You know, my oldest brother, he was in the Army, and he had served 2 terms in Vietnam and talked about how great the drugs was over in Vietnam. So, shit, I'm going to go to Vietnam. I don't know where it is, but they got some good dope. Let's go over there. But I didn't get to go to Vietnam, thank God. But anyway, I'm in the Marine Corps and made it through basic training. I didn't make it through there. It wasn't a piece of cake. Even Marines in here know it. It was hard as hell, but I made it through there. I don't know how, but I made it through. Ended up coming home, stayed home for 10 days, and went down to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and immediately started getting in trouble. I mean, trouble just everywhere I went, the trouble was there. And I got just all kinds of messes. We went down to Puerto Rico for some training. I went down for 45 days or so. I can't remember exactly how long, but and then we went down there for some training. And my first night down there, I'm drunk. Go to town, get drunk, get arrested. And I don't remember, but the guy that was with me was telling me the next morning, he said, "Man, you kept telling them, me no speak no Spanish, me no speak." And they were speaking to you in English, but you kept saying, "Me no speak no Spanish." Well, my hand. I got in trouble for that. Going to another country got in trouble. And then we're supposed to go out on this Mediterranean cruise. And, God have mercy, I missed the boat. I really did. I missed the boat. I was out drinking. And I missed catching the boat. I didn't make it. So I knew for sure that, you know, they'll put you on a chopper. They'll take you out to the boat. I've seen them do it before. So I figured that's what they're going to do with me. But they didn't. They locked my ass up. So I'm like, man, this ain't right, you know. This ain't right. This ain't fair. But anyway, after almost 4 years, I ended up getting an other than honorable discharge out of the Marine Corps. And I remember the day I got my discharge. They told me I was a disgrace to the United States Marine Corps. I was a disgrace to the United States of America. And I'm thinking, well, hell, I know that, but I need a drink. I need a drink. You know, I was out on guard duty one night. I'm a real smart person sometimes. So I had this bright idea. I'm out on guard duty. Nobody's around. I'm going to run over to the EM club and get me a beer and get back to my post before anybody knows I'm gone. I got a perfect plan all laid out. Well, there's a couple of problems with that. Number one, you don't leave your guard post no matter what. And number two, I wasn't sure exactly where the EM club was, but I was willing to find it. So I take my rifle and I hide it in these bushes out there, and I go looking for the EM club, and I found it. And I swear to God, I remember it like it was last night. I stood there, I drank the beer as fast as I could, and I looked up at the clock, and I thought, I got time for one more. I got time for another beer. 3 days later, when I was arrested, then they had a problem. They got an idiot with a loaded M16 rifle missing from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. An idiot was me. And I got arrested, and they wanted to know where the rifle was. I was out in the woods someplace. Where I was at on guard duty, it was dark. Hell, I don't know. I hit it. Hit it up some bushes. So they go out there and look for it, and they can't find it. They come back, and they're like, we think you sold that rifle. I'm like, no, I didn't sell it, man. It's out there in the weeds. Someplace, out there, some damn bushes or something. I hit it out there. I'm telling you, I hit it. So I'm sitting there, I got handcuffs on, shackles, and they got me handcuffed to this old metal bench. And the longer I sat there, the more I thought, damn, I might have sold that rifle. I might have sold it. Hope I didn't, because I mean, they was talking, said my ass a limb word for a long, long time. And thank God they finally found the weapon. But I had spent 11 months in jail for that. But they found the weapon. And that's when they decided to get me out of the Marine Corps. Told me I was a disgrace. I'm cool with that. Just let them give me a drink, man. That's all that matters to me. So I got out of the Marine Corps. I went back home. Went back to Louisville, Kentucky, and went to jail the first night there. I hooked up with a friend of mine. We got arrested. It was his fault, so in my mind. It's his fault I got arrested. I'm with him. I got some drugs on me. We've been drinking. He goes into his liquor store, and next thing I know, I'm sitting in a car. Police cars coming up in front of us and back of us, and I'm thinking, damn, he must have went up to rob this place or something. I don't have no problem with that, but just let me know, you know, in advance. And what it was, he had warrants on him, and the police just happened to go by and recognized him, and they had warrants on him. So when he comes walking out, he walks straight to the car like a fool. And then they come over, tell me to get out of the car. And I get out of the car, and his bag of dope falls on the ground. And they want to know where that dope come from. I don't know. I just got out of the car. I don't know. I have no idea where that dope come from. So they took me to jail, and I'm blaming Eddie. It's your fault. You know, you wouldn't have walked over to the car. Anyway, one of my brothers come next morning and got me out of jail, and he took me over to this apartment complex and introduced me to these two guys. I walked in, one of them had me a drink, the other one handed me something else, and they immediately become my two best friends in the world. Immediately. They told me I could move in with them. And they had a three-bedroom apartment, and we all three did the same thing for a living. None of us worked, so it worked out great. And, man, we had some parties. There was a girl that come over one night. I knew this girl in high school. Never did like her. Didn't like her the whole time I knew her in high school. But she come over one night, and we got high, and we got drunk, and we had sex, and she moved in with me. That's just the way it was. And for the next few years, man, all we did on a daily basis was get high, get drunk, yell, scream, cuss at each other, lie to each other, cheat on each other. It was just pitiful. And after a few years of doing that, we did what we knew we had to do. So we got married. And what you're supposed to do, man. So we did. We got married. And hell, I don't remember. I don't remember very little about the wedding, and even less about the honeymoon. I guess she had fun. I don't know, but I guess I did. I know the next morning I come to, I'm sitting in this chair naked with this empty bottle between my legs. I guess we had fun. We probably, who knows. That's just started off with my mother-in-law hating me from that day on. My first mother-in-law, she hated me. She hated me with a passion. Because I never would work. You know, I was always going to. I'm going to get a job. But I learned early on in life, man, not only do they want you to work 8 hours a day, they want you to do that shit 5 days a week. I'm like, there ain't no way. Man, that is a lot of work. Bill ain't doing that. No, can't do that. So me and my wife, our relationship continued on. You know, we were still getting high and drinking and lying and cheating on each other and just being real mean to each other. Apparently, she apparently took advantage of me one night in a blackout because she ended up getting pregnant. And and I told her, I said, you know, when the baby gets here, I'll stop drinking. When the baby, I ain't got no reason to do that yet, but when the baby gets here, I'll stop. And I meant it. I meant that with all my heart. When the baby gets here, I'll quit drinking. But it's not here yet. So I continue drinking and drugging and doing whatever I want to do. I'm going in and out of jail for different things, and in and out of detox. Never around taking care of her or her son during her pregnancy. 3 years later, she got pregnant again with her second child, and it was the same old story. You know, I'll change. You know, once the baby gets here, if we only got one, you can take care of him. We have two, I'll help. You know, but in my sick mind, it made sense to me. But I never did. You know, I never did. I really and truly, I was just a sick person. So I never was a father to either one of my children when they were younger. Never was a husband. Never was anything good to anybody. But anyway, life went on. You know, me and my wife, first wife, we would argue and fight. We'd talk about getting divorced from each other. We'd talk about killing each other. One day I'm going to kill her. Next day she's going to kill me. And it got to the point where she's like, you know what, man, go ahead and kill me. Just put me on my misery. Like, damn, why don't you kill me first? That way you can go to prison and I can be enjoying life hereafter. But anyway, it was just crazy. I had a mother-in-law. My first wife's mother, she enabled us to death. She really did. She took care of us. And I know for a fact she didn't do it because of me. I can promise you that. She did it for her daughter and for her grandchildren. And she set us up in an apartment or house, and she would pay to get all utilities turned on, buy some groceries. And then everything was good. I'd get drunk. And then I'd cuss her out and say all kinds of really nasty stuff to her. Then we end up getting evicted out of that place, and we move on to another one, and she paved to get everything turned on, utilities turned on, and it was the same old story over and over and over again. My wife tried to work, but I didn't want to work. I had no desire to do that. I mean, I could get a job. Getting a job was never a problem for me. I could get a job, and I just wouldn't show up, you know. But hell, I hear people all the time, go get a job. Well, shit, that's easy. Hard part is showing up and working. Well, my wife got to the point where she's like, man, I just can't take this no more. Even my mother was telling her, you need to get rid of him. You need to do something. You know, you need to do something. Things was getting real bad between the kids. You know, even my children was getting to the point where they didn't want nothing to do with me no more. Of course, I'm blaming her mother. It's her fault. And me and her separate, then we get back together, then we separate, then we get back together. And it was crazy as hell is what it really was. It was just crazy. But anyway, we finally got around to the point that I moved out, and then I went back to where she was living at, but discovered she had moved. And then I found out where she moved to, so I went over there and went in when she wasn't home. Waited for her to come home to tell her I'm home now. And she didn't appreciate that at all. And then I left again, and in and out of jail. Just insanity. Total insanity. We finally got to the point that she told me, you know, you can kill me, you can do whatever you want to do, but we got to quit this. You know, it's over. So I go back to detox, and I meet this girl there. I'm smoking her cigarettes, and she's buying me cold drinks, and she tells me her boyfriend, her husband is in this treatment facility someplace up in northern Indiana someplace. Her husband is, and her boyfriend's in jail. Well, hell, you need me. You need me. I'm smoking her cigarettes, she's buying me cold drinks, and I'm telling her how I'm going to take care of her when we get out of treatment. She told me she had a court date with this guy named Terry Kay, and I knew Terry. Terry was a probation officer. I said, oh, I know him. He ain't nothing. You know, I'll go with you to court. I'll help you. So I went with her to court that Monday, and I went to jail because apparently I passed out in the hallway while she was in court. I don't remember, but anyway. That first night that we got our treatment together, back up, we got our treatment together. I wasn't going to let her go. Hell, she had money. And we go over to her boyfriend's house and took some things he didn't need because he's in jail. So I took a couple pistols and a big old jar of money. I didn't know if she's going to be able to carry it or not, but it was a big old jar of money. And took his car. And she's like, man, we can't take his car. Like, he can't drive it. He's in jail, you know. We're doing him a favor. You know, hell, the tires are going to rot if it just sits there. She believed me, so we took the car, and her husband ended up coming home about 3 or 4 days before he was supposed to come home, because I was making plans to get out of there. And when he comes home and finds out that I'm living there with his wife, he takes that shit real personal. So she's looking at me like, you ain't going to take that car with you. I'm looking at her like, yes, I am too, because what am I going to tell him? You going to tell him it's your boyfriend's car? I don't think you want to do that. So I left because he threatened to kill me. I left with her boyfriend's car. A couple of days later, 2 or 3 days later, she finally gets in touch with me, and we get back together, and we go to this gas station. She talks me into going and getting her pack of cigarettes, which I shouldn't have never trusted somebody like her. As I go in and come, she's gone with the car. I'm like, man, what kind of a low-life person would steal my car like that? That is pretty disgusting. I had a truck that the bank wanted, because when me and my wife got separated, she quit paying for it. So it was crazy. I'm living in this truck that the bank wants. My mother's telling me, you know, when I would call her, she's like, you know, the bank people call here, they want their truck back. Kathy needs to pay for it. You know, it's in her name. She needs to pay for it. Ain't got nothing to do with me. Anyway, I kept that truck for several months before they finally got it when I sobered up. But I had it hit over in a friend of mine's house at one time in his garage. And God, it was just insane. But that's where I lived at. I lived in this truck for several months. And I called it my mobile home. You know, I could go wherever I want to. Shit, it's good. I was going to get a little mailbox and put on the side of it. Bill Chisholm, city at large. You know? Shit, I got it going on. And, God, it was insane. It was insane. But anyway, I'm sitting down on the River Road one morning, and I'm sitting on the River Road, but on the Indiana side of the Ohio River. And I'm sitting there feeling real sorry for myself, you know. Things ain't going so well for me. And I'm thinking about committing suicide. I'm thinking about driving my car across the bridge and just turning. I could visualize it in my mind, you know, the car going over the bridge and down into the water. And I'm sitting there thinking, damn, I better not do that. I can't swim. I better not do that. So I didn't do that. I got up and left. Later on that day, I'm going to get around to getting sober because that's what I'm going to be today, is sober. You know, I was in and out of detox, in and out of jail, in and out of treatment. You know, they told me one time that I ought to become a counselor. I knew more about that damn treatment program there than the people that worked there did, and I probably did. I knew how to break in the counselor's office and steal coffee. I had that down pat, and I did it every night. Ain't proud of it, but I did it. But anyway, it was on November 7th of 1988. I was coming out of a blackout. I'm driving down the street. I know Mark's here. He's familiar with it. I'm driving down the street, going up Brownsboro Road in Louisville, Kentucky. And I happen to look over to the right of me, and I see a street sign there that reads Hubbard's Lane. Well, Hubbard's Lane is a neighborhood I don't belong in. Indian Hills, real like Bill Meade. I didn't belong in that neighborhood. So I don't really know what I was doing there, but anyway, I come out black and I look over there and I'm like, damn, what am I at, man? What am I doing? All of a sudden, man, I start shaking. I mean, I'm shaking uncontrollably. I don't even know what's happening to me. Start shaking real bad. Start crying. And I don't know what's going on. I mean, man, what's happening? What is happening to me? I start hearing this voice, go to AA. Go to AA. Go to AA. That's all I could hear is go to AA. Go to AA. Then another voice is saying, it'll never work. Go to AA. It'll never work. Because I had been around AA. Never got sober, never wanted to get sober. But I'd been around AA for a long time. And I tell people all the time the truth, and the truth is I've never relapsed because I was never in recovery up to this point. So I don't think I took a break from drinking and doing dope. That's the best idea. I took a break from it from time to time. So I never did relapse. But anyway, I drive on up Rudy Lane. I go to this payphone, this gas station. That's back when we had payphones. And I call this treatment facility and I ask for this lady named Connie, who had been my counselor on more than once, who actually had kicked me out of the treatment facility twice, once for inappropriate behaviors with one of the female clients, which I don't have to go into details about that. And the other was selling narcotics to clients while I was in. And that I was guilty of both of them. But I told him, I said, man, the guy dropped some medicine on the floor. I picked it up and handed it to him, and he was loaning me a couple bucks. That's all it was to it. They knew that was a lie. Anyway, Connie kicked me out of there, and I called Connie that day, and it's the first time in my life that ever asked anybody to help me stop drinking. Not asked you for money, but that wasn't a problem. Or a ride. Or let me come in your house and stay for a couple months, you know. But I would never ask anybody to help me get sober. But that day I asked Connie, and please, I didn't just ask, I begged her, please help me. I can't live like this no more. And I mean, I can't live like this no more. I don't want to live like this no more. She asked me where I was at, and I told her. She said, well, why don't you get somebody to come get you and bring you over to my office, and we'll talk about it. I'm like, no, I can drive myself. She's like, well, sound like to me you're still intoxicated. I still drive. You know, go walk, that's for damn sure. So anyway, I go to her office, and we sit up there, and I talked to her for a long time. And I really don't remember what all we talked about, but I'm pretty sure we probably talked about me. I'm pretty sure of that. And Connie told me that day, she said, but I'm going to be honest with you. And this is the honest truth. There's nothing I can do for you here. There's nothing that this treatment facility can do for you other than keep you here away from a drink for a few days. But you know more about the treatment program than most of the people that work here, so it's not going to do you no good to go through treatment again. She said, this is my suggestion. Go back to AA and do exactly what those sober people tell you to do. And man, I've made a lot of people mad in AA. I'm like, yeah, I know. And she asked me if I knew this guy named Donnie. I said, yeah, I know him. I don't like him. She said, you don't lie. I said, no, man. I see me. He'd be walking. I swear to God. He would get there. He would walk around and shake everybody's hand in this place and laughing and joking and having a good time. And I'd be sitting back here thinking, I hope that son of a bitch drops dead. I couldn't stand him. He was one of the happiest people that I'd ever known. And I hated him. She said, well, I know Donnie pretty well, and I think he would make a good sponsor for you. I don't think so. So she calls him up and gets him on the phone, and they sit there and chit-chat for a few minutes, and then she hands me the phone, and the first thing I tell him was, Donnie, I don't like you. He said, well, Bill, I don't like you either, but I hope you stay sober if you want me to. I thought, well, you're about arrogant prick, ain't you? I don't like you. He said, why don't you meet me tonight at 7 o'clock over at the Northside group? I said, man, the meeting don't start till 8 o'clock. He said, yeah, I know what time it starts. I've been going there a lot longer than you, but meet me over there at 7 o'clock. He said, you think you can go between now and 7 o'clock tonight and not take another drink? And I told him the truth. Man, I don't know. I don't know. I look up at the clock to the right of me. I'm looking. Little hands on the 4. The big one's on 12, man. 7 o'clock. Hell, that's a long damn time, man. I don't know. I don't know if I can do that. He said, why don't you do that? Why don't you just stay there at the detox, at the treatment facility, and meet me over there at 7 o'clock. I'll be there waiting on you. So I asked Connie. I said, Connie, can I stay here till 7 o'clock? She said, well, you can go downstairs, you know, sit with the staff down there, and you know, go to the bathroom, let the escort you to the bathroom, because you can't be trusted. I'm like, a man of my caliber, you're telling me I can't be trusted. I come here asking for help. So I stayed there till about 5 minutes to 7. I got in my truck, and I drove over to the Northside group, because it was just right down the street. I mean, you could drive there in 2 minutes. And I met Donnie at the meeting, and we talked, and I honestly, God, I don't remember what we talked about, but I'm pretty sure we talked about me. And I do remember Donnie telling me that night. He looked me right in the face. He said, boy, from this day on, you never have to take another drink. And in your case, you never have to do no more dope. No matter what happens to you, you never have to do that again. But there's some other things you got to do. If you want to do them, I'll help you. If you're willing to stay sober, I'm willing to go to hell with you to help you stay sober. If you're not, see ya. He gave me a few quarters, and he wrote his phone number down. He said, I want you to call me. Now, I'm thinking, I'll call, all right? Make sure you ain't home. I'm gonna come over and steal everything you got, because I do not like you. I don't like you at all. But I started calling Donnie. The first couple of times, I called him and said, how you doing? I said, I'm doing good. I'm doing real good. I said, all right. Next day, I called him. I'm doing all right. After about the third day, he's like, man, I'm not doing so damn good. Maybe you ought to be my sponsor. I knew then, and that's just not the way this conversation is supposed to be going. I said, man, I really want a drink. You know, I'm nutty in a fruitcake. I don't even know what's going on. And we started talking, and I met him at a meeting. We talked. And Donnie used to let me know. He said, I don't put a lot of demands on anybody I sponsor. It's real, real simple. If you want what I got, come and get it. You know, this is where I'll be at. and I'll be willing to help you. But you got to come and get it. I can't bring it to you. You got to come and get it. So I started going to meetings, and Donnie told me right up front, he's like, you get to meetings early, shake people's hands, get to know people. Don't associate with no women whatsoever. Stay away from all of the women. Sit right up front on the front row. And if by accident a woman don't know no better and she sits down beside you, then you get your ass up and move to the other side of the room. Damn. So I did that for a long time. He asked me about a job. I'm like, I don't work. I don't work. He said, well, what do you do? I told him, he said, well, you can't do that no more. You know, and be in recovery. He said, we got to get you a job. We got to get me a new sponsor. That's what we got to get me. So he got me a job making $5 an hour. And I told him, I said, man, I can't work for $5 an hour. He said, how much you make now? I said, well, I ain't got a job right now. He said, well, I'll be damned. You just got a $5 an hour raise. You went from making nothing and got a $5 an hour raise. Ain't that a miracle? I'm like, man, I don't hear that stuff. So I went to work, even though he didn't want to. Then he started asking about the kids. I'm like, man, my kids don't want nothing to do with me. The last time I seen my son, he was 6 years old, and he told me he hated me and he wished I was dead. He got that from his mother. He's like, no, I think your kids probably want something to do with you. They just don't want nothing to do with you when you're drunk. So a whole chain of events happened, and I started calling my children, and Donnie said, now call them and tell them you're going to come out and get them. And you go get them. You take them out and you buy them an ice cream or something. Spend a little bit of time with them and take them back home. Don't say nothing to their mom. So I go get the kids and I take them out and spend a little time with them. Take them back home, cuss their mom out, call Donnie. He's like, no, that ain't what I said to do. So we'll go give it a couple of weeks and go back and get them again. So couple weeks go by, and I go back and get him. I take him out, spend a little time with him, take him home, cuss her out, and call Donnie. He's like, no, you're just going to keep doing it till you get it right. Stop saying anything to her. That's when he told me, she has a right to be wrong, and you have a right not to tell her about it. And you need to exercise your right and keep your damn mouth shut. I'm like, okay. So I started paying child support, and then I got this thing where I got to go to court for non-payment of child support, even though I was paying her child support, because this had been going on for a while. And I told Don, I said, man, I gotta go to court for non-payment of child support. They're probably going to lock me up. He said, man, don't worry. Don't worry, man. I got you covered. I'm like, really? I'm thinking he's going to get me out of jail. He said, I'll bring you a soft cover big book. You have nothing to worry about. That ain't what I want to hear. Donnie helped me get my first place to live, too. And when I tell you that, I don't mean he paid the rent, deposit, and all that stuff. What I mean is he told me about this place. Because back in the day, you just put a sign up in your yard, apartment for rent. That's the way it was. You didn't have all this stuff you got today. And Donnie said, I go by this place, and there's a sign over there that says apartment for rent. I got the number here. You call the guy and tell him you're interested in an apartment. I'm like, man, I ain't got no money for it. No deposit or anything. Don't worry about that. Just call the guy and tell him you want to come by and look at the apartment and tell him the truth. You know, you're drunk, you're a dope fiend, you're a liar. You might not pay no rent, but you really need a place to stay. So I called the guy. Going to Donnie's house, I called the guy. And he's like, yeah, meet me over there. So I go over and meet him. And I said, man, I'm just, I've been sober for a couple of weeks. I don't have no job history. I just started a job. I ain't got no money. Don't have no deposit. And he's like, we can work something out. And I left there that night with the keys to that apartment. And I'm thinking, if I would have known it's that damn easy, I would have done this a long time ago. Well, Donnie knew the guy, but I didn't know that at the time. And he done had it all planned out that the guy's going to let me move in the apartment just to get me off of the streets. And it was a miracle. Anyway, I started paying rent what I could and started paying child support. I called my kids up and I told them, I'm going to come get you Saturday, you know, and I'd actually go pick them up. I would go get them and spend a little time with them. Back when I was drinking, I'd call them and tell them, I'm going to come get you. you know, a month later, I call him and said, I swear to God, something happened last time. But this, I swear to God, this time I'm going to come and get you. And I never would go get them. But I started going and getting them and spending time with them and doing what I should have been doing. Every once in a while, cussing her mom out. I just had to throw that in there because I just didn't like her. You know, she come to the door one morning, and she's about half drunk, and she had a glass in her hand. I know it's vodka because she didn't like water. And I said something to her about she might have a drinking problem, and she let me know. And the only problem she ever had was me, and she got rid of that problem. Okay, I never said another word to her about her drinking. But she had a problem, in my opinion. But anyway, I started spending time with my children, and life really started getting better for us, for me anyway. My first AA anniversary rolled around, and my son was at that meeting that night. My daughter couldn't be there because she was real bad sick, but my son was there. And after that meeting was over, my son come up to me, and he hugged me like he ain't never hugged me before. I mean, he was crying. He said, "Dad, I love you, and I'm so proud of you." That alone was worth me not taking a drink for a year. If nothing else good happened, that was worth it right there. Just to hear that coming from my son, that was worth me not taking a drink. Then the next year, things got a little better. Got a better job, and I got a better car. I remember I had a car, and Donnie's like, "Man, don't park that damn car in my driveway." He got one of those newcomer cars. Oil just pouring out. He put a quart of oil in it every two blocks. He's like, "Yeah, man, matter of fact, don't even bring it in my neighborhood. I'm ashamed people see that car and you coming in my house. Don't even come in my neighborhood with that car." So, but anyway, it was a car and it worked for me. But I got a better car and got a better job. And things started going along good. And January 13th, 1991, I had gone through these steps or working through these steps. And I did that four-step. A searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. And I was not one of these people that wrote all that stuff out and just felt real great about it because I'm looking at everything and there wasn't nothing real pretty there, you know, because I was brutally honest. And me and Donnie climbed up in a treehouse and I did my fifth step with him up in a treehouse. And I'm afraid of heights, but he said he didn't care because we're going to go up there anyway. And we did. We sat in a treehouse for hours, and I did that fifth step. He told me that time it about as close as God as I could get, so that's why he took me up there. So. Who knows? He had a sense of humor. But we did that fifth step together up there, and I had that amends list. You know, later we did a six and seven step, and I had that amends list. And my ex-wife was, man, she was on an amends list. I owed her more amends than I did anybody else because I had put her to years and years and years of pure miserable hell. I owed her a whole lot of amends, but I wasn't willing to make them to her. And Donnie used to tell me all the time, he said, "Do not make amends to her until you sincerely mean it. Otherwise, you're just asking for permission to hurt her all over again." So it took me almost 2 years to get to the point that I was ready to make amends to her and sincerely mean it. And I did that on Christmas Day, 1990. I made my amends to her. And she brought up a couple of things I had forgotten all about. And she made it back on another four-step. But I'm so happy that I made my amends to her. I'm so thankful for that. I had no idea. Three weeks later, she was to be brutally murdered up in Jeffersonville, Indiana. It's across the river from Louisville. And she was at a bar, her and her husband. He left her there for whatever reason, which they was probably fighting. And whatever happened, but this guy, he took her down a river road and he brutally murdered her and tried to dump her body in the Ohio River. He got sentenced to 60 years in prison. He got a 40-year sentence for murder and 20 for aggravated circumstances because he kept beating her after obviously she was dead. And I got custody of my two minor children. My son was 10 years old. My daughter was 7 years old. And it was a mess. It was a mess. For the next several nights, every night my son would come crawl up in bed with me. and lay there, and he would cry, and he would ask me that question, "Dad, why did that guy kill my mom?" "I don't know." "The answer I had, I don't know." And he'd cry himself to sleep. And I get up and I call Donnie, "Man, Donnie, I can't deal with this, man. I can't do this. I can't deal with this." He said, "You're absolutely right. You can't deal with it. But we can. Me and you and God and a whole lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, we can deal with this. You know, we can deal with this. But you're right. You can't." So we made it through all that stuff. And it wasn't painful. It wasn't easy. It was very painful, but we made it through all that stuff. And 5.5 years later, actually 22 years ago today, my ex-wife's sister was shot to death by her husband. 5.5 years later, and I'll never forget, my son, it was on a Saturday, my son looked me right in the face. He said, "Dad, why did Uncle John kill Debbie?" I don't know. Then he shot a police officer, and he was sentenced to death plus 50 years. They give him death sentence for murdering his wife and 50 years for attempted murder of a police officer. And he died in prison 12 years later. But no matter what happened, I didn't have to take a drink over there. Thought about it, but I didn't have to. But that's when I know for sure that we stay sober. I get drunk, but we stay sober. You know, me and Donnie had a beautiful relationship before he passed away. I remember I was probably eight, nine months sober. And I'd been doing everything Donnie told me to do. He's like, "Man, you know, stay away from these women. Stay away from these women." So I did. About 9 months later, I told him one night in mess, I said, "Donnie, we need to talk." He said, "What we need to talk about?" I said, "Man, we need to talk about having sex." He said, "I am not having sex with you. I ain't talking about you, dumbass. I'm talking about with a woman." I said, "Man," I said, "I'll be honest with you, Donnie. It has been so long. I don't even know how to do that." He said, "Oh, it's real simple." And he pulls this piece of paper out of his pocket. He starts writing something down on this piece of paper, and he hands it to me. And I'm standing there. We're in an AA meeting. I read it, and it reads, "In, out, repeat if necessary." I said, "What the hell is that?" He said, "That's directions for having sex." And he grabbed that piece of paper on my hand, scratched out the part, said, "Repeat if necessary." He said, "Don't worry, boy, you ain't gonna get that far." I'm like, what the hell? I thought it was fun, but man, what happened here? Donnie asked me one more question. I'm gonna tell y'all one more question. Donnie, he had a sense of humor, and I loved him for it. He asked me one night, he said, "Boy, you ever been drunk in a blackout?" "Oh, yeah, a lot. Man, I've come to in places and no idea what I was doing there." He said, "Well, have you ever had sex with a man?" I'm like, "Hell no." He said, "How you know?" I ain't had a drink since. That sobered my ass up right there. You don't got to worry about Bill drinking no more. No, sir. No, sir, you don't got to worry about Bill drinking. You know, I'm today that I met with one of my sponsees today, and then I met with another one. We went to the noon meeting. And a couple of them's here tonight, and my sponsor, who I thank the world of. I love John. I love John to death, man. And John's the one person I'll tell the truth to. You can ask me how I'm doing, I'm going to tell you I'm doing okay. John asked me how I'm doing, I'm going to tell him the truth. I ain't doing worth a shit. You know, and it's Buster's fault. So. But I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I tell people, man, I do what I do to help you. You know, I sincerely mean that. Today, things has changed for me. I'm on this oxygen 24/7, and I don't like it. I don't sit with John in meetings because he'll reach over and squeeze this if I start saying something that he don't want. If I carry on too long, so I'm like, oh, hell. Stay away from him. But John, you mean the world to me. You really do. You really do. But my sponsor, my first sponsor, Donnie, on his deathbed, I'll never forget this, on his deathbed, he told me, he said, "Boy," now he always called me a boy. That's all he ever called me. 24 years was a boy. I said, "Donnie, you know, I do got a name." He said, "Yeah, boy, I know." whatever. He said, boy, whatever you do, don't ever stop helping another drunk. Don't ever stop helping another drunk. So as long as I'm physically capable of doing something to help somebody, I'm willing to do that. I'm willing to do that. I sincerely mean that from the bottom of my soul, man. I'm willing to do that. Whatever, I'm limited now. I first moved here, John got me introduced with the guy, and I used to go out to Cumberland Heights and do fifth steps, sometimes two or three times a week, and I just can't do it no more. But I do what I can do. I do what I can do. You know, today my children love me and accept me just exactly the way that I am. My grandchildren love me. My granddaughter thinks I'm the greatest thing in the world. Of course, I agree with her, but she thinks I'm the greatest thing in the world. She just turned 12 years old. She's in the seventh grade, and, man, it's unbelievable. I got four grandchildren, and they all love me dearly. I'm going to close by reciting this poem, and it pretty much sums up my whole life. And before I do, I hope somebody got something out of this. I hope somebody did. I just always pray that at every prayer, when we open a meeting, my prayer is, God, please let me hear something that I can use for myself and hopefully pass on to somebody else. That's all I want to do. I'll recite this poem for you, and it's titled How It Works, and it goes like this. Utter confusion, misery and pain, humiliation, remorseful, ashamed, dreading to face the light of each day, and not wanting to hear what people say. Like, where's your willpower? Where's your pride? They don't understand it deep down inside. I wish I knew the answers to give and how to find the courage to live. I had taken the pills. They told me I should. And I tried all the cures, but they did no good. I made many promises and met them too. But the compulsion to drink is stronger than you. One day a friend happened to say, I know the answer. I can show you a way. All it takes is an open mind. Believe what you hear from your own kind. I went to a meeting and read chapter 5, and the steps made some sense and hope was revived. I saw living proof of what faith can do. It worked for them. Why not for you? One day at a time, they told me to live. They said, easy does it, and learn to forgive. Be humble, be honest, and help when you can. Pass on what you learn to a new man. I heard him repeat the serenity prayer and soon realized all my answers were there. Now when someone asks, can miracles be? May I always reply, take a look at me. Thanks for helping me stay sober, guys.